Welcome to Reboot Republic, Ireland's politics and social change podcast, where we talk to the change makers and thinkers about the issues and ideas and solutions for a better republic and planet. This is the podcast of hope. I'm your host, Rory Hearn, and joined, as always, by my co-host and alter ego, Tony Groves. Tony, how are you?
I've got a nice big divot in my head. I don't know if anybody's noticed, though, you know. It's hard. I've been singing I Fought the Door and the Door Won all day. But anyway.
Tony, yeah, come on. Let's just move on very quickly. We're delighted to be joined by Kerry Anthony, who's the outgoing CEO of DePaul. Kerry, great to have you with us.
Thank you. Lovely to be here.
And also Mairead McGinn, who's the Director of Fundraising and
Communications
with DePaul as well. How are you?
Yeah, good, thanks.
Good. So we're going to have a conversation today about homelessness, about the housing crisis, both in the north and here in the south as well. And it'll be interesting to look at the contrast and differences in responses and the situation, the crisis. And also, in particular, Kerry, your experience having been in a CEO of DePaul since 2007. And DePaul is an organization that works with homeless people and families and women and children in terms of providing supports. And you yourself have worked in the field of homelessness for over 20 years in London, Glasgow, Dublin and Belfast. And you have a master's in social work from Glasgow. And in terms of kind of your work and how you've seen the crisis, we'll say since 2007, how does it compare now to what it was in 2007?
Well, I suppose the numbers have pretty much doubled in that period of time. The thing that's most noticeable, I suppose, is the issue to do with family homelessness. So, in terms of single people, there were always around about 5,000 people experiencing homelessness across the country.
Yeah.
But now we're moving into the over 10,000 zone. And obviously it's been so well recorded and documented around families and children living in hotels and the family hubs and things like that. So that's been a major change. The other thing that I would say that has changed has been a reduction in HSE funding into services as well, which has been hard because if you see homelessness as purely a housing issue, it's really quite short-sighted because there's so much complexity around people's support needs. Certainly in terms of what we're seeing now, I suppose, you know, if I think back 10 years ago, if a woman was pregnant, she would end up getting into a bed and breakfast accommodation, probably around 4 or 5 months pregnant. We've had women go into labour at 9 months pregnant in a one night only emergency bed. So that's quite shocking, really. Mm. We've seen some younger people coming out of the care system into the one night only system. Mm. People going to work, talking to people, you know, going, we've been down, not that long ago, we were down with Minister Murphy and, you know, talking to him about the one night only system and saying that really it doesn't work, you know, it literally provides a stick and plaster, but we would like to see a move to minimum 6 month stay hostels. So he's agreed to that, you know, he supports that now as well. But when he was there, he was meeting men who are going out to work in the morning and coming back to the hostel at night or coming back, trying to get back into the one night only bed at night because it's not guaranteed that you will. And if you think back, like maybe 100 years ago, we have a project in the city centre there called Back Lane, and it would have been like a working man's hostel originally.
Yeah.
So you're starting to see some patterns of, you know, history repeating itself really, which is always somewhat soul destroying, isn't it? Whilst you're trying to maintain the optimism to support people to move on and through and out of homelessness ultimately, you know, so it's been it's interesting to watch. I feel that we've gone slightly backwards, and a big part of that has been the housing crisis, obviously, because there's just more people coming into emergency accommodation again. And when you have a crisis like that, you do provide short-term solutions, but short-term solutions are simply just that. They don't necessarily provide the supports and the full package of care that people need. And then you worry around people getting stuck in a system as well. So it's you don't want to be bleak about these things because certainly from our perspective and thinking about our staff and volunteers who work with people who are homeless, you want them to be the opposite of bleak. You want them to keep hope alive and, you know, work to motivate people to reach their potential and, you know, try to get access to services to move out of homelessness. But it is a very, very difficult environment. And, you know, I've been approached by people before where they've said to me, I know somebody who's sofa surfing. Yeah. What do they do around, you know, reporting as being homeless?
Yeah.
And I'm like, try to do everything you can to make that not happen. Because when you get into a system, it's quite difficult to get out of it.
And do you think that housing, the homelessness crisis has become normalised that are we accepting it as it's just there now, and the levels of, you know, this increased level of homelessness. And I know you had, you launched your Real Doors of Dublin campaign, and there was a quote from you in it, which I thought was quite good in terms of, you said, you know, DePaul recently launched our awareness campaign, The Real Doors of Dublin, highlighting the ongoing homelessness and rough sleeper crisis. And we're urging people to stay sympathetic to those experiencing homelessness. There's a danger with such high numbers that the public may see homelessness as an issue that can't be solved, that homelessness is simply part of everyday life. And I was looking at it, I was quite struck by this idea that people would become unsympathetic to homelessness and see it as actually part of everyday life.
Mm. I suppose Maria can maybe say something about why we did that campaign as well. But I suppose whenever we're saying that, I have to be really careful, because we're very fortunate in terms of the support that we get from the public. Mm. And we have people who are really sympathetic to the issue and are really committed to supporting us on an ongoing basis to try to address homelessness. But there's no doubt, because it's human nature, isn't it? When you see something all of the time, you become almost, there's potential to become immune to something nearly, yeah, you know. Yeah. So for us, it's really important. Particularly around the single people, because there's been such a spotlight on the issue to do with family homelessness, rightly so. As you said earlier, I'm a social worker by qualification, so yeah, the rights of the child are absolutely paramount.
Mm.
But at the same time, I really struggle around thinking about single people who are homeless and the challenge it is for them to get out of homeless services. And sometimes people say things like, you know, about people making themselves homeless and yeah, trying to jump queues. And I think if you're a single person, you're homeless in the city, your choice really initially is to sleep rough or to come into what has been an emergency, emergency one night only service historically. Mm. And I just don't see why people would do that, would choose to do that. It's not a great option, you know.
I also think as well, like that piece about, you know, moving the system or whatever, like if a system is broken, you know, fundamentally, people will try their best for whatever they can do. You know what I mean? Like, yeah, it's just, I mean, the reason we did Real Doors of Dublin was we were approached by an advertising company, Bloom Advertising, and the feeling was that these numbers are coming out all the time and they're only increasing. And the feeling was that, well, what does it need to get to before really something substantial happens? Mm-hmm. And so that's why, that was kind of what interested us. Like, as Kerry said, we're very fortunate that, you know, people are very sympathetic,
mm-hmm,
and really do support us. But just in a wider scheme, you know, if you think about the trolley crisis, that has been going on for a long time.
Yeah.
And there has been a bit of, well, that's just a figure that comes out every year now.
And every year we break the record.
Yeah, and nothing, you know, so it's just about, mm-hmm, well, we were trying to think of an image that would try and kind of bring that back home to people. And we were looking at different concepts. So there's, 128 people sleeping rough at the moment, say that was the last figure. And we were looking at what would that look like as 128 doors, you know, and then, you know, bringing it down or whatever. But it was just around trying to bring it back to, that's actually a person.
Yeah.
And it was around the time, wasn't it, the guys at Bloom had been thinking about, a few years ago, people might remember Jonathan Corey had died, yes, outside the building in the centre of town. And I think they had felt like, okay, well, what's changed in the 3 years subsequently? So, I think it was their sense that, yeah, maybe talking to colleagues, it's not, you know, people are becoming used to it.
We've just passed the 2 year anniversary of Simon Coveney standing up and saying he would end the scandal of people living in hotels.
Yeah.
That's, I think it was last week he said, 2 years ago he said that. And when you put that in context, yeah, unfortunately, we're battling the narrative that it is actually just, and unfortunately, it's also a deficit in opposition and a deficit of other things, because they play the game on those terms. They play in terms of the numbers. Are they at 10,000? Where close are we at 10,000? But as you say, each one of those is a person. It's an actual story. It's a real person, mm-hmm, in suffering. And we don't, in those numbers, just for listeners' benefits, we don't include the guys sleeping rough. We don't include women fleeing domestic abuse situations. We don't include couch surfers. You know, they have to go to Park 8 Street and, mm-hmm, and present as homeless, or they don't actually factor in those numbers. So the numbers game is already rigged, I suppose, is my point. What I'd like to ask actually, yourself, right, is just in terms of the campaign though, when you try to individualize it. Do you find that that's the individual stories that break through, or is it just, you know, because you have to anonymize anything, your own experiences?
Yeah, so, and I suppose we would try and protect the right of our service users in that we would always say that this is just a moment in time for them, or should be. So we would anonymize, but they are the stories that, that appeal the best to people, because really at the end of the day, it's just one person talking to another person about a, an experience that they're having right now. So yeah, it is. But I think the campaign that we did with Bloom was trying to, it was quite a big outdoor advertising campaign, and it was just trying to say to people, look, stop for a minute and see, like, this is still happening, and this is I suppose still a really big problem for us. But yeah, it is the stories of the individual.
You're absolutely right, because even I was referring earlier on to the minister coming down and visiting Bury, as it was then, with ourselves, and you know, we've been talking a lot about the, I was going on and on about getting rid of the one night only beds and moving to supported temporary accommodation. But actually, whenever, you know, a minister hears from people who are actually living in the services and they're saying, you know, this isn't working for us, it's hard not to hear that. And in fairness to himself and to the DRHE, they have shifted the policy around that, which I think is a really a positive thing, because, you know, and I've never been homeless myself, but when you're working in the field, you tend to try to think about how would I be able to cope with that. And it's a hard, as Marie had said, it's a hard system to navigate. And, you know, if you think about the idea of going into a service and a nine month pregnant woman going into a service, and all the anticipation, because a mother has, about having a baby in her tummy, you know, she's just like any other mother. And you're going in and you're walking around, you're going out at 10 o'clock in the morning and walking around the streets and then coming back, you know, maybe 9 o'clock at night. Like, how do you do that? How do you cope with that and keep any sense of dignity for yourself, belief in the future for yourself, hope for your baby? So for me, like, that doesn't work. So supported temporary accommodations aren't the solution either. Like, housing is the solution, but at least if you have somebody in accommodation 24/7, where they're getting support from professionally trained staff, where they are getting signposted to access accommodation, where they're meeting resettlement workers and they're getting on properly assessed and onto the housing list, there's much more potential. So for me, the one night only system going again is a positive. Not that necessarily our temporary accommodations are of, you know, there's lots of.
Because it was an issue raised, obviously, by, you know, particularly the Apollo House, do you know what I mean, occupation.
Yeah.
And, you know, other protests have been around the quality of, do you know what I mean, temporary accommodation. And it is clearly an issue. And, you know, homeless people have spoken about, I'm afraid to go into the hostels, you know, because of drugs being there, or because of, you know, people being bullied or beaten up, or, and particularly for single men, it's a big issue that in a way people go, you know, how could anybody be homeless on the streets when there's, you know, all these bed spaces there? And, but there is a reality that temporary accommodation is really, and the hostels, the quality of those is very important in terms of being able to, number one, offer people in terms of being able to have somewhere, really offer them somewhere to get off the streets. But then even if they're spending, you know, a month, 2 months there, 3 months, like, the quality of that is important, isn't it? And has that, you know, what is the situation around that?
It is very important, and the situation around that is not ideal. I mean, I'm not going to sit here and defend that, because, you know, we've sat at our board table, you know, in terms of our board of trustees, really having a conversation, because we firmly believe in the policy of housing first, like, firmly believe in that. But equally, we're a Vincentian organisation that have got a strong value base about supporting those people who are most in need. And so, if you don't have access to really good accommodation yourself, and you're working in partnership, and the government can see that they've got an issue and they're opening up stuff in a short-term basis, we've had to ask ourselves whether we're best placed to do that, because of our value base and because of how we train our staff, and then hope that our staff will be able to deal with the issues as you've outlined. And no organisation's perfect. You couldn't claim to be. But if you're coming from that basis of a values base. So there's this, like, contradiction really for an organisation like ourselves, where you are delivering temporary accommodation in buildings that, you know, in an ideal world you'd want better buildings, but at the same time, the housing to deliver on the housing first policy isn't there yet. And, you know, we were talking earlier on about the difference between the north and the south. And there was supporting people was the funding program that was brought back into Northern Ireland around, I think it was around about 2003. And it funds not just homeless services, it funds learning disability, mental health services and domestic violence, as you spoke about earlier on. But that whole principle of the supporting people program is to provide supported accommodation for people to move into independence. So one of the policy initiatives around that was in relation to accommodation. So they did away with accommodation, largely they did away with accommodation around big communal spaces. So they, generally speaking, worked with housing associations to build accommodation where people had access to cooking facilities within their own space. So building life skills for the future. So even though you can't say Northern Ireland's ideal and the Republic of Ireland's not ideal, there's pluses and minuses in both. But the building standards up there have been pushed up by supporting people, by that funding stream. And I suppose down in Dublin, we're in Dublin today. So I suppose for me in Dublin, around about 2012, was it, or maybe a little bit before that, 2010, we had an initiative called the Pathway Home. And that was very much promoting the Housing First agenda. I think it was Jan O'Sullivan when she was in post had first adopted that. And I was so behind that. And, you know, we did roadshows for our staff because it did mean that we were going to reconfigure services. And it did mean the whole concept would have been that you would have reduced emergency services. And so there's lots of threats to that and challenges to that for staff and around their own futures. But for me, we did roadshows with our staff about, and I was saying, if you genuinely believe having your own place to live and your own security is the right thing for our service users, we have to get behind this and we have to work together to deal with the challenges for ourselves. And our staff did get behind that, you know. But then, of course, the crash came.
Yeah.
And so, as I said, then we sort of have stepped back a little bit again. So under the Pathway Home, you know, we would have been saying that large hostels of, you know, 60 plus beds weren't suitable. They needed to be reconfigured to become, you know, and we would only have a certain cohort of emergency beds. We wouldn't have transitional beds and everything would be focusing towards long-term housing. And then, you know, in an ideal world, sure, isn't that perfect? And that's what we'd want for everybody. But that's absolutely not where we are now. And it's hard sometimes when you're working in the sector and you've been in the sector for as long as I have to see those policies sort of reverse almost on themselves.
Go backwards in that sense of where it was back in 2007 or even 2010, as you're saying, the idea of housing first rolling out as being people accessing housing first.
But Rory, just to come in there, just to say the same time in Finland, when they did roll out housing first, they did it at the same time that we were going to roll it out. And they continued with it. And at the same time, we had a fairly similar level of homelessness that they had. They've more or less eradicated it to the point where they actually do count the things that we don't count. They count families in overcrowded homes, you know, the couch surfers, those sort of things. And we actually pulled back from it. So,
it is very easy to be critical and to only look at the negatives. And, you know, I'm always trying to be a bit balanced around it because in fairness, you know, under Rebuilding Ireland, they did appoint a national director for Housing First, and they do actually have a Housing First plan with targets. And I've been meeting local authorities outside of Dublin as well around what role we can play in delivering towards those targets. So, like I would say, absolutely, people who work in the NGO sector and those in local authority and indeed in government are committed to the policy and the concept of Housing First. Our big challenge is how do you get the housing to, you know, run along behind and catch up in terms of actually getting bricks and mortar. So I think in terms of here in Dublin and across Ireland, there's still a firm commitment to Housing First. It's just the speed at which we can deliver on that. So I wouldn't want to paint the picture that that's been forgotten about. And it was a policy that we had back then, and it's not the case now because the tender went out a while ago for the Dublin services, and there's other tenders going out around the country at the moment. So, but it just is, you know, when do we have enough houses to be able to say we've been able to deliver on that? Because ideally, I know it's, you know, a cliche to say, but ideally we should be working ourselves out of a job.
Yeah.
You know, or certainly working ourselves into a job where we're supporting people in the community rather than delivering accommodation in congregated settings unless that's necessary, you know.
And how would you, in terms of just that comparison between the North and the South in terms of housing crisis and homelessness, how does it compare? Like, is Ireland, is the Republic much, much worse?
Yeah, well, it is worse, certainly worse in terms of rough sleeping, most definitely worse in terms of rough sleeping. So it's fun. It's very hard to compare sometimes because it's like comparing apples and oranges, you know, because how we count homelessness in Northern Ireland is a little bit different than how homelessness is counted here.
How is it counted in the north?
Well, in the north, they talk about like people who are unstably housed as well. So it's not just people in temporary accommodation.
Mm.
So if they say 19,000 people presented, around about 19,000 people presented as homeless in Northern Ireland last year, maybe 10% of their, or half of them were given full duty applicant status in terms of assessed under the homelessness criteria. But then you would have maybe older people who are unsuitably housed would be strictly speaking counted as homeless.
Mm.
Whereas here we're counting people as homeless who are living in emergency accommodation or on the streets or in hotels as opposed to people who are housed but unsuitably housed. So it's hard to compare and contrast completely, but from a rough sleeper's point of view, the situation is definitely much worse here than it is in the north.
Emergency accommodation numbers compare?
Again, higher here, but then population headcount, it's again.
Yeah.
So my major concern about the north of Ireland is with the introduction of welfare reform, and we've had mitigations in place in Northern Ireland that they haven't had in the rest of the UK, which are only in place, I think, until 2021 maybe. And if those go, the concern would be that the issues to do with family homelessness will follow the way they have here. You know, that people won't be able to afford private rent, and the private rented sector is seen as a solution to the issue there in the north as well as it is here. So there's it's so funny, isn't it, for being like on the same island. Mm. They're quite different, but they're comparable also. And back to your point, that actually the stories, people's individual stories, are all so different, but there's real comparisons about people getting stuck in a system that they find it hard to navigate and get out of. In Northern Ireland, we've been able to deliver Housing First services there ourselves, as to Paul, and not ourselves. You know, it is a collective effort, actually, Housing First, very much so, but we've been the organisation commissioned to do it. And we've seen people maintain their tenancy. This is long-term sort of street drinker population.
Mm.
We've seen 78% of them maintain their tenancy after 2 years. So, and again, that's been a sort of mixture between public housing, social housing, and private rented sector.
Yeah.
So it's, I think if you saw the private rent, if you were really relying on the private rented sector, that's not going to work. So then that does beg the question about social housing build, and for the north as well, and here as well, the public centre.
Phenomenal.
Oh, it's really good. And the thing for me about Housing First, we started it from our project in Belfast called Stella Maris. We've projects similar here, but Stella Maris was a project for long-term street drinkers, and it's a wet surface, colloquially known as a wet surface, or low threshold, as we would like to call it. So where people historically wouldn't have gotten access to services because they were actively drinking and didn't want to stop. So with Stella Maris, like, you know, we have an alcohol managed program. People come in, their alcohol is administered over the course of the day, their food's recorded what they take in, their medications recorded what they take in. So you start to get a picture of how people are going to be able to stabilise their life in some way.
Mm.
There's about reintegration into family supports. All of those pieces of work are done.
Proper wraparound services.
Yeah, but those lads were sent to Stella Maris to die. That's the thing that always got me. You know, that Stella Maris was seen as the end of the road for them. Okay. And so they were literally, I'd heard people say, oh, they'll die at Stella Maris. And for me, you know, if you try again to put yourself in those shoes, if you think about if that was my brother or my father or my sister or my cousin or whoever, what would you want for them? And to die in a hostel for 23 people and, you know, isn't, you know, with a label of homelessness. So for me, what Housing First did was say that homelessness was just a point in time, including for those guys who were most in need. And we were able to put them into the community with wraparound supports in place, as you say. Mm. And again, people, and I had to really challenge myself in this because I remember clearly being at Stella Maris one day before we set up Housing First. And I was telling the story at an international thing recently because it really did make me think differently. There was one of the guys, this is 11 years ago probably, was being settled into the community, and the staff had said to me about him going out, and I said, oh my goodness, are we just setting him up to fail? It's never going to work.
Mm-hmm.
11 years on, that fella is still in the same house, mm-hmm. and he comes to this service, this annual service that we do every year, and he comes back, and he lives in Hollywood now, mm-hmm. County Down, very nice, don't you know? And, you know, my parents sometimes are down there, they know him, they mm-hmm. bump into him in the street. So you sort of, it makes you think, and that's what got me thinking about Housing First for the Stella Maris client group, because you know, the fact that they were being sent there in people's mind mm. to be the end of the road just wasn't okay. And the fact that now 78% of those people are maintaining their tenancy after 2 years, you know.
Isn't that
but fair it, play? It is, and it shows the point being that homelessness is not inevitable in the sense of it's not, doesn't have to be a permanent state, because there is, we've heard that narrative a lot down here in terms of this idea, oh, you'll always have a certain cohort who are going to be homeless. You'll always have, you know, levels of home, and even saying that our levels of homelessness are somehow, do you mean, comparable to other countries and not even, you know, higher. That what you're showing there in that work is that, you know, homelessness can be solved.
You see, I think, because I came from it, like I've been the chief executive of DePaul for 13 and a half years, but I started off as a volunteer in a hostel in London, and I've been a project worker and a deputy manager and everything in between.
Yeah.
And the thing for me that always frustrated me about homeless services back when I maybe had less influence than I'm able to have now in the organisation was that we set services up to meet our needs rather than to meet the needs of the people who needed those services, if you get what I mean.
Yes, absolutely.
So I think Housing First is a really good example of how you have to challenge yourself to say we can do things differently.
Mm.
So when we first came here and we opened up a service for intravenous drug users, nobody else would do that at the time. That's how DePaul first came to Ireland.
Mm.
They do it now, thankfully. And I hope that we've played a part in making that happen. But again, when we opened up Angel Street, which was the first wet service, that wasn't done at the time. So, but now I think Housing First is the new, idea around how do we do things differently. And I think working in this area of work, you always have to ask, how can we do things differently? And the service users are obviously the people who know their own circumstances best. And if you walk into any of our projects and you ask somebody, what do you want? They want their own house and they want their own key to the door, but they also don't want to be isolated.
Mm.
And they also do know, most of them who are very, have complex needs, do know they need a bit of extra help.
Mm.
So for me, Housing First is that.
I just want to explain briefly, because we talk a lot about Housing First.
Oh, yes.
What it is.
Oh, yeah. Sorry.
Because certain people would know it, but you know, lots of people don't know.
Nerds like us know.
So I suppose, put simply, it turns the normal concept of dealing with homelessness on its head. So historically, we would have said, somebody was on the streets, they get into emergency accommodation. If they do well there and they behave themselves, they get into transitional accommodation. They might stay there for 2 years, which, by the way, would normally still be a communal setting. And if they really prove themselves as able to, then if they're lucky enough, they might get their own house. Whereas Housing First turns that on its head and says, actually, what we need to do is, first of all, despite what your needs are, we put you in a house and we provide the wraparound supports to support you in that house. So housing is what it says, I suppose, Housing First, and then assessing people's needs to put supports in place to make sure that they can sustain that house. And I suppose it is saying, you know, like, people have a right to housing.
Yeah.
People have a right to exit homelessness. People have a right to leave the label and stigma of homelessness behind them. And don't, there's lots of people who live in the community who've never been homeless but need a lot of supports and have a lot of wraparound supports in place, and that's just what we're doing for these guys.
And I suppose two things really come back to me when we've spoken a couple of times to Lalani Farah, the UN Special Rapporteur for Housing. One of the points that she's repeated is the doorway to human dignity, or the pathway to human dignity, leads through your own front door. Mm-hmm. It's one of her main points, and obviously, and the right to housing. But the other thing is that, and it goes back to the narrative around that, you know, the homelessness, that these people, as you said, maybe they were taking emergency accommodation in a wet situation where it could be. And when you say, well, and there is that, oh, he's an alcoholic or he has drug problems. And we do see that narrative. A body was discovered. He had problems.
Mm-hmm.
As other people who are in the services have said, clearly, if you were on the streets for more than a couple of days, you'd probably want to develop a habit yourself just to escape the trauma. So it's not a chicken or egg situation here. These people weren't broken. And as you, and was showing that 78% of people are maintaining their own tenancy after 2 years. I mean, that economically, and I'm saying that because I'm very mindful that we always hear this nonsense of don't give them a free house. We need to push back against that, because economically, this makes much more sense.
Well, you know, when we first set up the Housing First project in Belfast, the housing executive who were, we had said, let us pilot this to see if, and we're lucky now because we've got it into the strategy in Northern Ireland as well, which it wasn't previously. So when we were doing that, we had said to them, look, why don't you independently review the pilot that we're doing, which they did. And I know, like, when you start talking about value for money, which, you know, we are talking about people at the moment, but value for money is also part of it. Unfortunately, that's how the world works. But when we asked them to look at the value for money piece, and you can read a lot of the work around that any which way you want. But anyway, what the researchers who did it, who were independent, said, for every pound you spent on housing first, you'd save £15 elsewhere in the public purse. Wow. So by the overuse of accident and emergency, criminal justice system, et cetera, et cetera. So they had a, you know, it's on the housing executive's website. People can look at it. But, so they were basically saying, yeah, this is a better outcome for people. Yeah. And we know it is because delivering large, congregated setting accommodation with a lot of staff on site isn't a cost effective model, and it's definitely not a human effective model.
Well, unless we're calling it co living.
communal living with, in the sense of though, but and which we talk about, you know, people who are becoming homeless are, you know, a lot in terms of economic issues, but there's mental health issues as well. There's, you know, supports that are required, and there is a clear issue though, and you talk about the contradiction within, you know, the contradiction or how that, and it's almost, it must be a tension as well. And, you know, we all feel it, those of us who are engaged with housing as an issue and homelessness, you know, and advocate around it, is that tension between, you know, providing temporary accommodation, which in a way is a plaster on the issue, like the idea of a plaster on a wound. And in a way lets the government policymakers off the hook to a certain extent that they can say. And even, you know, the rollout of, for example, family hubs, which, you know, are been touted as somehow a positive thing. And rather than seeing, you know, I was looking at the figures just before I came on, that, you know, 2,300 people in supported temporary accommodation in Dublin, 2,300 in these forms of, you know, temporary accommodation, 2,000 in the private emergency accommodation, which can be hotels and hubs, that somehow that with the temporary accommodation, how do you balance that between saying, you know, this is not right, this is not acceptable. As you say, we need housing first, we need homes. That how do you avoid becoming that plaster?
Well, it's hard to avoid because when people are in a crisis.
Can you avoid it?
Well, we here collectively haven't done a good job at avoiding it because we do have it. You know, that's where we're at the moment. And I don't know if it's completely avoidable. I haven't seen it in Northern Ireland either as being avoidable. People do point to Finland and places like that where they have invested heavily financially in turning what would have been temporary accommodation into housing and housing first projects.
Yeah.
So there are examples that you could point to where you say they've basically got it down to functional zero. We work, DePaul is part of an international group of charities as well called DePaul International.
Yeah.
And we have a partnership with the DePaul University in Chicago and have set up the Institute of Global Homelessness. And there are people there who are looking at 20 vanguard cities to look at how do you work towards getting homelessness down to functional zero.
Yeah.
Back to your point that yes, people might become homeless for a period of time, which would be a short period of time, and you turn that around quickly so you don't have these large institutes. So there's work ongoing looking at that. Do I have the answers to that right now? No, I don't. And we definitely have had conversations, as I said, around our own board table and our leadership table and with our managers and staff, you know, that the balance between doing this and not doing this. The one thing I would say is I remember when we were, because people, especially if you're working in homeless services, you want to do everything that you can, don't you? You know, and our staff certainly have a real sense of that. And I'm just thinking back to 2 years ago whenever we were opening up one of the emergency accommodations, the one night only accommodation. And we had our staff conference the day before it opened, and we were asking people to go around, you know, at the tables, the warm up session, you know, tell one interesting fact from the table. And the amount of people from the table who said, I'm going to work in this service tomorrow morning and I can't wait. And it was because this sense of going, we do have a crisis on the streets and we need to do something to respond to that.
Yeah.
So then I think that's my job to say, okay, we're going to do that and we're going to respond to the crisis because that's in line with our values. But equally, it's my job to make sure I can have those conversations in an appropriate way with the minister and with others, and bring them, because I do, we talk about seeing as believing. I do think bringing people down to services, getting them to talk to the people who are actually affected by homelessness, getting them to try to walk a few steps in their shoes starts to try to influence change. And as I said, that did influence the move away from the one night only beds. But, you know, and again, you know, around the family hubs, there's been a lot of debate around that. What I know from our work with families and hotels is that is very less than satisfactory than even the family hubs, you know, because, you know, and I think you hear about kids traveling across town to go to school, teachers talking about children falling asleep in the classroom now, access even like to the very basic things around laundry and cooking facilities and stuff like that. So, I don't.
And the temporary nature of hotels that we're seeing, like in terms of the, you know, it's summertime now, and I think, you know, as families being basically booted out because it's tourist season, you know, and losing their places. Whereas, yes, in the hubs and other, they have that some sense of permanency, even though there are also issues around licensing agreements and them having to try and go out and be looking for housing in the private rental sector. But I was quite struck yet by a school principal was talking around the impact on children of the spending time in homelessness and being homeless and seeing it in the classroom and thinking about it as well. And I was thinking about it. It was like for other people, imagine you had to put your life in, as we describe, like, you know, a small bag and that's what you had to bring with you. And how is a child supposed to have any of their things that they have, like their teddy, their bits and bobs? Like, I have small children as well. And you see, you know, it's not about, you know, huge material goods, but, you know, the things they have that are their childhood that define them, that they're going from one place to another, they lose it. And you just think, you know, how homelessness, you know, degrades no matter how long people are, you know, people. And obviously you're seeing that. And, you know, what do you think isn't the question was asked, you know, what do you think will be the impact on children into the future of this?
There's no doubt that it's going to have a significant impact. I mean, we have seen intergenerational homelessness before. And so if I think about some of our family services, particularly in Northern Ireland, I don't know what the statistics are, so I wouldn't pretend that I do, but I would say the chances of somebody who's been through homeless services potentially repeating that pattern, we have seen that in our family services in Northern Ireland, where we've seen, a child living in the hostel as a child and coming back to the hostel as an adult. Now that's heartbreaking. And I think that, again, you find children masking, you know, sort of not telling the truth about where they live because they know there's a stigma around homelessness. So it's undoubtedly going to have an impact on people, and just even in terms of it does have a, you know, longer term. If you aren't in a position to be able to study for your leaving cert well, and you don't get the results that you're capable of getting because you're living in a hostel with your mother and potentially two other siblings, or in a hotel, you know, that does limit your life opportunities as well, doesn't it? You know, you can't pretend that it doesn't, because we know that education is such a big factor in terms of exiting poverty and having more life chances. So there's no doubt that, you know, there are. And that's not to say people can't overcome those challenges. I don't ever like to sort of just box people off and say, because people are always able to, you know, develop potential and
absolutely, there are
move forward. Yeah.
There are outliers.
Yeah.
Unfortunately, we've talked to occupational therapists and professionals in the field, and they express great concern. JP Swain expressed great concerns on this very podcast about what is happening to childhood trauma that we're building up that they may not even know, be able to express properly at this stage. You know? So that is a big concern. And I would be very worried that we have in 10 years time or 15 years time or 20 years time another Taoiseach standing up in the Dáil and issuing an apology for some of these things that has happened in the last 10 years. And that is my strong feeling on it, you know.
Do you see that, you know, society's values and, like, you know, the two questions, one is, how do we accept this as a society? Who notionally, you know, most people believe, you know, in the values of social justice and fairness, and how do we tolerate this? And secondly, you know, how does the political system tolerate it?
So I wouldn't say I don't think the average person tolerates it. You know, I think they are I think people have been, I mean, we were talking about the campaign earlier on, but I think certainly, you know, people have really, really been appalled about what's happened around families and homelessness. Mm-hmm. So I think that the more the problem is, the more the challenge is, people feel helpless to know what they can do about that, because if the answer is housing and we don't have housing, you know, I think people have a sense of helplessness about it. So I don't necessarily think that the general public think it's acceptable or, you know, and it's definitely not. From a political point of view, it's very difficult, isn't it? Because, you know, the cycle of politics is such that it's a short period of time. And what we need here is a long-term solution, and a long-term commitment, around housing. So it can't just be based around party politics.
And multi-government.
Absolutely. You know, I think that's the only way to really address these fundamental societal issues like this or health. You know, it can't be, it has to be a long-term plan, that can be committed to from a party perspective, really, because this is about people's life and life opportunities or limiting opportunities.
Do you think there's a lack of understanding of housing's role with people? In the sense that, like, it's valued primarily as a commodity. Do you know what I mean? This asset that people have where they accumulate wealth, and that we don't think enough about housing and its fundamental role that it plays in people's needs. Do you know what I mean? To live a life of dignity.
It is an interesting point, and certainly I think people would have made that point around the time of the housing crisis, you know, pre-housing crisis, when we were living in this sort of housing bubble.
Economy.
It was a booming economy, and I think people were thinking that if you didn't have more than one house, you weren't doing well, that was definitely the financial argument, isn't it? I think what's become more striking in people's minds over the last number of years, and it seems to be easing slightly, if you're listening to the radio and stuff, you would have had a couple who would have been considered middle class, well enough off, like maybe a teacher and somebody working in retail or something, you know, and they were saying at the end of the month they were struggling to buy bread or milk and potentially looking towards homelessness. And I think that starts to focus people's minds a little bit more on the fact that, oh, this could actually happen to me. And you do begin to think more about, I think it was one of the organisations in Northern Ireland, one of the homeless charities in Northern Ireland a number of years ago, ran a campaign saying we're all two paychecks away from being homeless. And when you actually start to think about it and you start to break it down, that's not far from the truth, sure it's not. So, I think there's a bit of both. I think that, you know, we did have a, and you would worry about that happening again, wouldn't you, in terms of...
Well, there was an interest. Did you see the statistic yesterday that that housing alone has pushed the living wage up by 40 cents.
That's right.
Just housing's impact. And never mind, you know, the cost of anything else, whether it's electricity or broadband or whatever these other things are. Just housing alone has pushed it up by 40 cents per hour, which is, and wages have increased by 8% over 5 years, and yet the living wage has increased by almost 30% in 1 year.
Because contribution of costs. And I suppose what I was trying to get at there is this idea that, you know, we haven't thought enough, obviously in homelessness, you know, broader in society, we haven't thought how important a house is, a home is, to provide security, that it needs to be affordable. But in sense of the people that, you know, so we have got to this point where we allow the market decide, you know, as to whether housing is provided or not, rather than recognizing this should be a core social policy, a responsibility of the state.
And almost like setting a level of what is affordable housing, you know, as well. And, there needs to be a lot more debate around that, I think. And certainly like a lot of the housing associations are having those conversations and thinking about that and thinking about, you know, different models of can't think of the word now, you know.
They're different. We're going to have whether it's affordable, whether it's cost rental, whether it's all of these different housing models that we're looking at. And the government will tell you that they're exploring, Rory. You know,
they are. They're talking about doing cost rental now, you know, shifting to a model where we've more housing that's provided not from the market.
Yeah.
And that's, you know, as Tony said, cost rental, that's not for profit, that's cooperative. And I think that's the shift that we need to see, and that we do value house and see housing, treat housing as a home, which is what it needs to be for people, rather than just this commodity. Because the other hand, what's happening as well is we have a huge influx of global finance that's coming in, buying up the developing the co-living, buying up rental properties that are going to, as I describe it, locking a permanent unaffordability into housing, because they're going to rent it out at huge rents. There's going to be no affordability through that. That we're turning to those as kind of housing providers rather than the state.
Yeah, no, I definitely think that we definitely do need the state to step in a little bit more in relation to the housing, because it is sort of bleak at the moment, because you do think unless something drastic happens, we are heading into another problem, really, in terms of, and at the moment we saw the slight dip in homeless figures.
Yeah.
In the most recent figures.
Yeah.
But that's a slight dip. And you do worry that the worst is not yet over in terms of people being able to stay in their own housing at the moment. So if we're not learning from what's happening now and adjusting our policies for the future.
Well, we have threats of Brexit, we've threats of the global economy, and we've all of these things. But I would rather focus on the hopeful section where you've said 78% of people who went into the housing first model successfully held their tenancy. So I feel really positive that if we can adopt something like that, and I hate to say it, but actually work towards phasing out services that you guys tried to provide.
Absolutely. So I mean, that's always been like, and it's interesting whenever you go for me, again, just referring back to Stella Morrison, the Housing First Piece, because I've been around the organisation for a long time. It used to be that I go to Stella Morrison, you know every single person there, like every single person.
Yeah.
And now I go down to Stella Morrison, I probably know two of the residents there now, because there is, and that is a really positive thing.
Mm.
Now, it begs the issue for us about how do we challenge ourselves to do service differently, because that was a service that was set up specifically around drinkers, and it was an alcohol managed program, whereas now there's again changes in what's going on. There's a lot more young people in that service now. There's a lot more people with poly drug use, so it's a changing profile of client group as well, which then we have to ask ourselves, well, what do we have to change about the service to be able to accommodate those people in the service? So, you know, we'd be going down the route at the moment of doing a review of that project to say, okay, does the traditional model, our traditional model is not traditional to everybody, but does our traditional model of alcohol managed program work for this full client group, or do we need to look at a blended approach now moving forward?
Let's steal the best of the Lisbon Dissuasion Commission or whatever it is. You know, they've all got different models, but none of them are going to fit. Like, Lisbon won't work in Belfast, but some sort of thing will, I think that's really, really positive.
What do you think needs to happen to make Housing First work in the Republic?
Well, I think access to housing, and as your point, back to your point about access to affordable housing, and I think that the HSE, the health funding, needs to, and there is health funding there, but I think if we're ramping Housing First up, Housing First, the name says Housing First, but it's that there's what comes after that, and what comes after that is the wraparound supports, and that's mental health supports, it's addiction supports, it's community integration support. So those other services have to come with it,
And in terms of the role of the private rental sector, you mentioned that is a big issue in terms of the policy. Do you see there's a danger in over relying on that?
Yeah, absolutely.
And what do you think is the problem there?
Well, firstly, it's not affordable. You know, largely it's not affordable for people. It's not well regulated in terms of making it affordable. We also know, like in Dublin, for example, as well, that, you know, it really, really isn't affordable, and our guys are going to be well down the list in terms of being able to get access to private rented accommodation here. We also know that if landlords can change the rent, they will ask if they can increase their rental. We are seeing people, we hear a lot of people being coming into homeless services because the landlord's increasing the rent, or the landlord is saying the property is going to be used for a family member or for sale. But that might not necessarily always be the case. And obviously there is the PRTB in terms of regulation, but they're, again, they're trying, but they need greater investment to be able to deliver on that sort of regulatory side of the house as well. So, and again, for in the Northern Ireland context similar to here, it's very badly regulated. And so if you're going to rely on that as a solution to homelessness, or part of the solution certainly to homelessness, I think. But that's a really, like, you probably know better than me as well, that's a very complex piece, because, you know, obviously the landlords have a view, and of course they do. And rightly, you know, that's rightly so, they should have a view. So it's a real fine balance, isn't it, about what you can enforce on somebody who owns a property. And, you know, I'm coming from the point of view of trying to end homelessness. So, you know, I'm always thinking about how can we make this work for people who are, you know, have complex needs, are living in hostels, have access to very little money of their own. You know, they're quite often in benefits. But a landlord is thinking, how do I make this affordable for me? You know, it's my property. And you can get that as well. And because the system is such, again, as you would know, there's so many, I think what the term they use is incidental landlords. Like, you know, people who have a one property, and you can absolutely see from a personal point of view, back to your point, where there's larger organizations or groups coming in and taking lots of property, that's a different issue. I think we need to think about how we look at the making that a better regulated environment, you know.
Yeah, and just to finish up in terms of your values, which you mentioned, can you talk to us a little bit, like, what are the values in terms of DePaul, and then also yourself, like, what motivates you to keep going, you know, in this, you know, very very challenging you know, area?
Well, so for DePaul, I mean, the name says something about that. We were originally set up by the Society of St. Vincent de Paul, the Daughters of Charity and the Vincentian Fathers, and we were set up in London back in the late 80s in a response to young people sleeping rough, back in the other days of welfare reform, when a lot of young people were turning up in London, and Cardinal Basil Hume at the time opened up one of the Westminster Cathedral buildings to try to provide an emergency response.
Yeah.
Knew that wasn't sustainable, so asked those three partner agencies to put money in the pot to develop a charity to look after young people who were homeless in London. So that's where we come from. So we've got this sort of Vincentian tradition that we talk about, but we obviously are an organisation that work with people of all faith and no faith. We're not a religious organisation as DePaul, but we do take inspiration from the past. So Vincent de Paul, although he was a priest 400 years ago in Paris, he was a social reformer. He believed in using charity as a way of achieving social justice. He bridged the gap between the rich and poor, so he used, like, very wealthy individuals to support his work. He was probably the ultimate fundraiser back then, you know. So we would take inspiration from then, translate it into our modern day values. We talk about, we believe in the potential of people.
Mm.
We believe in being part of a wider civil society. We believe in action over words, and we believe in rights and responsibilities. And those are the four values that we have, I suppose, taken from the Vincentian tradition and derived those into modern day values that we talk about within DePaul all of the time.
Yeah.
So from recruitment, from, you know, when we first interview somebody, right through to people having a one-to-one meeting with their manager or staff conferences. We have a Vision, Mission and Values Committee, which Maria chairs. So we're always thinking about how do we encourage people to work and deliver our services from that value-based approach. So the answer around personal values, then, that was easy for me when I came to DePaul, because those personal and professional values married very well with the organisation. So, and I suppose on leaving the organisation, I'll be taking those values with me in terms of how I'll work elsewhere. And I think I was reflecting, like, yesterday in Belfast, we were having a leaving event for myself, and I was talking a lot about the concept of resilience as well, you know, and you were saying about how do you keep yourself motivated. And I think, you know, it's interesting whenever you go out and you visit our services, and people who have much less fortunate circumstances than I do personally myself, being so kind in the most difficult of circumstances, it really teaches you a lot about their personal resilience, you know. And like, I've been clear every day when I've worked in DePaul that I get up to work with people, for people who are homeless, on their behalf. I don't always get to see them in the way that I used to. But I think there is this thing about keeping yourself motivated and keeping yourself resilient and always keeping your eye on the prize of what it is you're trying to achieve on behalf of other people, because you're really only the conduit to help that happen, you know. So I think that's probably... I don't know, that's probably it for me, really. What do you think?
Yeah, I think even when you go back to talking about the response to emergency, like we really do talk about the values every day. Like the example that I would always use is we've had very difficult conversations, I suppose, at senior level around the response to the crisis and is it the right thing to do?
Yeah.
And Kerry's always the one who says, wait, hold on a minute. Like, what do our values say? And, you know, at the time of one of the places opening, I was walking up from the Dart every day and seeing huge numbers of people sleeping rough at the time.
Mm.
And we kind of just had a conversation about like, well, what is the right thing to do right now? And it's to put our words into actions. So let's get people in and off the street and start working with them. And then in a space of 2 years, that service became full SDA. So it's not an ideal solution, but you do come back to your values about, well, what can we do right here, right now to support people? And honestly, it's an incredible organization because that is fundamental to every conversation we have is those four key values. And it's been really interesting to watch it, I suppose, from my point of view. Like I'm in the organization, it's over 3.5 years, but to see what Kerry has done from the get-go, and it's, there is an expectation in this organization that everyone lives that way. And that's why, like, it's a, she says about HR, but it's a scored thing on an interview. So if you don't have that value
and
question.
It kills me because it's like, it's an easy question if you have any passion for this client group and if you've read our website. It's an easy question to get good marks on.
It always strikes me when charities and NGOs like yourselves, you know, talk about those values in contrast to, you know, the public service, for example, which there's a lot of people hold those values, but the organization within the public service doesn't talk about them in the sense, doesn't nurture them in that way. And maybe we could see public services be different if they did.
I'm going to speak in defense of them. I would say there's a lot more value in them than when I go into some of the banks I work for, where you say corporate social responsibility as a tagline. So, yeah. You know.
But I think, I mean, it's funny with if you're going to, well, I think leadership, how you lead is a choice.
Yeah.
Like it really is a choice. So you can go in and you can lead in a certain way and you can get stuff done. But sometimes it can take longer to lead through values because you actually have to sit down and talk about if we're dealing with a disciplinary, well, do we believe in the potential of that person? Or if we're talking about that in terms of, well, what are our responsibility, if we believe in rights and responsibilities as an organization, what's our responsibility to that individual and have we seen that through, you know? And if you, so like for me, if it becomes part of the conversation, then that's a big success, but you have to be completely deliberate about it. I had a lovely conversation with a senior civil servant yesterday in Belfast who said he was going to ask me to come in and talk to the civil service about values and leadership. And I thought, yes.
That's great. You said tone from the top. I've only met you the last couple of 2 hours and I think that is the nice way to do it though. If they're your values and you live them.
Yeah.
Exactly. Listen, Kerry, Mairead, thank you so much for coming in and joining us
on
Reboot Republic. It was great to have you in.
Thank you.
Thank you
very much.
Listen, folks, do head over onto patreon.com. Here's my pitch. Rory needs a new pair of shoes, okay? He's giving me an awful hard time. He's wearing the same pair of cons and his toes are coming out of them and he won't be able to run the marathon if you don't give him the price of a cup of coffee. Talk to you all soon. Take care. Bye-bye.